for the post-Christian today, Lewis realized you needed to do some pre-evangelistic work to help them understand the basic ideas of Christianity.
I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. In addition to being your host, I'm also the author of two books related to Lewis. More details about them at the end of the show. With me today is Dr. Brian M. Williams, and he is the author of C.S. Lewis, Pre-Evangelism for a Post-Christian World. This is his first Lewis-related book. I'll have him tell more about himself later in the show. But for now, welcome to All About Jack, Brian.
Hey, William. Thanks for having me. I'm so grateful to be here.
Let's go ahead and jump into this book of yours. Now, for those who are well-read in Lewis's fiction and statements he's made in other works, they'll immediately know what you're talking about, but first explain pre-evangelism and post-Christian for those maybe unfamiliar with these terms. And secondly, then why write a book if there are those who already know about these concepts?
Sure. So let me start with the term post-Christian, and then we'll work backwards to pre-evangelism. Lewis writes an article in Strand magazine. I think it came out in 1946, William. And the title of that article is A Christmas Sermon for Pagans. And he says in there, when I started to write the article, I suddenly realized how difficult this was going to be because are there any pagans left in England? And when he talked about that, he described the pagan as the pre-Christian. And the word pagan goes back to the Roman Empire when Christianity had begun to spread. And you had in the outer-lying villages, the pagans who had not yet encountered Christianity, and those were the pre-Christians. And Lewis gives us a comparison between what he calls the pre-Christian and the post-Christian, which is someone living today and in Lewis's day. And he says there are three differences. The first, for the pre-Christian, this individual was religious. He was full of reverence. They believed in spiritual reality. They thought that the world was more than just what the five senses perceive. The post-Christian, however, if they are religious, it's pretty well that you keep that in the closet. There's no room for that thinking or talking in the public sphere of life. So that's a major difference. The second was the belief in objective morality, belief in objective right and wrong. The pagan or the pre-Christian thought that right and wrong did not depend on how you felt about that, but that this was a real structure of reality. The post-Christian today, however, that's a contentious idea, this notion that there's a universal or an objective morality for all times and all peoples and all places. And the third that Lewis tells us is for the pre-Christian, this person was not only aware of an objective morality, but he was aware that he had not lived up to that law, that he had broken it. And so he lived, Lewis tells us, with a deep sense of sadness, that his wrongs needed to be set right. And not just in terms of his interactions with society, but with reference to God or the gods. You think about the post-Christian today and this notion that there's a real moral guilt before God is not a very common belief. And so Lewis struggles with this. And he's asking the question, how then would we introduce Christianity to people who they're not pre-Christians? They don't have the furniture in the room yet. We're dealing with post-Christians, which is as different, Lewis gives us the analogy, it's as different as a street where there used to be houses built that were knocked down. It's as different from that to a field where no development had ever been made before, no houses had ever been constructed. And so for the post-Christian today, Lewis realized you needed to do some pre-evangelistic work to help them understand the basic tenets, the basic ideas of Christianity so that you could go along and then the full gospel could be presented. The evangelism part of that could then come. So in doing this, what I was focusing on, William, in my book was how Lewis used imaginative fiction to do that. He realized not only were these beliefs not popular anymore, the ones held by the pre-Christian, but that there was quite a bit of disdain towards those beliefs, so that you might not even get a fair hearing for the gospel if you're too explicit about it up front. That is with some people. So Lewis thought, how could we sneak these ideas along in such a way that someone's defenses might not be up? And he realized that imaginative fiction would be a great medium to use, to where you could take these true things that you find in Christianity, and that you find even long before them, that the pre-Christians, the pagans held on to. How could you take those ideas, dress them up in different clothing, and give them to the person through an imaginative story? And then once you'd gotten them that way and they realized that they actually believed those things because their defenses weren't up, then you could sort of pull the veil off and say, aha, it's Christianity that really pulls all this together. Now, the reason that I wrote the book, William, is because I realized that that situation of the post-Christian versus the pre-Christian, that divide has only widened since Lewis's day. And we have the same issue, the same struggle, the same problem today. And I'm really encouraging Christians who have the gifts to write stories like this. And you could do it with all sorts of different mediums. You could do it with music. You could do it with painting. You could do it with different art forms. But I'm encouraging Christians in particular who have the giftedness to write, to think about what ideas need to be recaptured and how can we put those in this imaginative dress up and give those to people in a way that would enchant them, that would arouse delight and joy, as it did in Lewis's life, so that then when the gospel comes, the soil had been prepared for it.
Well, now, while most who pick up your book are likely to be acquainted with Lewis, you actually spend your first chapter giving a relatively short biography of him. However, your focus is somewhat narrow as to the types of details you give. Why did you do this, and what are some of the core things about him that you underscore?
Yeah, so William, I wanted to start the book out with a biography on Lewis because I was aware that there are many people who've read a book or two or three from Lewis, maybe Mere Christianity, maybe The Problem of Pain, maybe The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or something like that, but that many of those same readers would not be aware of Lewis the man. So I wanted to take a short treatment on Lewis and set a context for his life that would show what I'm going to argue for the rest of the book, and that's this. What role did imagination and joy, what Lewis calls a deep longing, a yearning for the transcendent that's awakened by mythology and stories and music for Lewis, what role did that play in Lewis's coming to Christ? And then throughout the rest of his life, how did he use that? How did that impact his writing and his apologetic works? So my focus in telling Lewis's story, William, is really to keep joy, that is imaginative longing, central. And Lewis does that in his own autobiography, you know, in Surprised by Joy, that some will have read. He keeps that central, but his own biography cuts off right after he becomes a Christian. I wanted to show the rest of the story, how after he'd become a Christian, how did he capitalize on what he discovered about imagination and his view of reality, the world that we live in? How did he capitalize on that and use that to pre-evangelize people so that the gospel could gain a fair hearing? And I'll tell you, William, the one letter that I came across from Lewis that really sold me on his doing this intentionally was the letter that he had written to Sister Penelope. Mm-hmm. She had written to him after he had written the first book in the space trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, 1938. She writes asking, you know, I loved the book. Is there going to be a sequel? And Lewis responds to her and he says, yes, there's going to be a sequel. As you know, there would eventually be a trilogy. And he tells her, would you believe that of the 60 plus reviews that have been done, only two of those reviewers caught on that there was any deeper meaning behind what I'd written? And he mentions the bent one. Right. If anyone's read the book, the bent one, of course, mm-hmm. Satan. That this had any reference to anything outside of an invention of my imagination. And then Lewis says, we might use this great ignorance for the evangelization of England. We can now smuggle theology into people's minds under cover of romance, by which he just means a fantasy story. And so I realized Lewis saw that could be done. And, you know, those books were written before the Chronicles of Narnia. So throughout the rest of his life, as he's writing these fiction stories, he's doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating how he did that, and then, you know, the reaction that people had. And yeah, that letter from Sister Penelope is very good in terms of keying in on the ideas that you present. Now, next in C.S. Lewis' Pre-Evangelism for a Post-Christian World, you go deep into Lewis's view of reality, which you explain is sacramental. What does this mean, and how did his understanding of medievalism influence it?
Yeah, so William, the word sacramental, for some people, that word will conjure up the idea of religious rituals that people in this or that denomination would practice as a means of, you know, mediating God's grace to some degree. That's not the sense in which I use the word. I use it in the way that Lewis will use it. And he means by that, very simply, that this world down here that we live in, that we experience on a daily basis, that there's more to it than meets the eye, that there are deeper realities behind the physical world that are real, they're true, they're a part of the structure of reality on the whole, and that this world that we experience, if you like, points higher to the transcendent at the same time that it participates in it. So the analogy that Lewis is probably famous for is the shadowlands, the shadows and the solids. You get this at the end of The Last Battle, the last book in the Chronicles of Narnia. You know that they've gotten into New Narnia. Aslan has brought them into the real country. And they notice the children and the others and Lord Diggory, they start to notice this looks like old Narnia, but it looks different at the same time. The colors are more vibrant. It's somehow richer. Everything seems more solid. And it's Lord Diggory who is, you know, the professor. He's the professor from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He's the one who says, you know, don't you see? Don't you see? This is the real Narnia. Everything that really mattered in old Narnia has been brought forward. And then he makes this comment. He says, it's all in Plato. It's all in Plato. Goodness me, what do they teach in these schools? And they all laugh at him. Well, they get the point. He's pulling from Plato's idea. And probably the most famous analogy in philosophy, maybe the most famous piece in all the history of philosophy, would be Plato's cave analogy. The idea, Plato envisioned these prisoners who'd been chained up facing the wall, the opening of the cave behind them. There's a fire between them and the opening of the cave. And in front of the prisoners, there's a wall upon which people are walking and holding stick figures. And as the light of the fire casts on to the stick figure images going in front of the prisoners, a shadow of those is cast on the back wall. And Plato said, how would it be if those prisoners had broken free and they'd turned around, having all their lives only known what they'd seen before them? They thought that the shadows were the real reality. But if they could get out of the cave and go out into the bright world around them, they would see not just shadowy figures, they would see real things, real birds, real trees, real mountains. And they would know that the things that they had seen in the cave were only faint images of the more real things. And that idea is one that Lewis is pulling forward. Plato had this idea that this world was in some sense a copy of a higher, more real reality. Augustine, the early Christian, believed that as well. But he helped us where Plato could not. Augustine locates those ideas, those essences, what we call the universals, in the mind of God, so that when God speaks this world into existence, what he's doing, he's drawing from these perfect, eternal ideas that have resided in his mind, and he speaks the word and creates the world, this material world of the particulars, as a copy of that world. And so in that way, Lewis thought, this world is a clue to something higher and more real. And he tells us somewhere else that you see patches of God light in the world, these rays of light that come down is his metaphor that he uses. And if you follow those lights upward, you follow the sunbeam back up to the sun, you see the ultimate source of it all. So my view of sacramental is just that, William, that the particulars down here participate in some way in the universals, in the essences, and ultimately lead us back upward to God, the Creator.
Yes, it's all very interesting when you think about it that way. And you do a great way of going through and explaining that in your book. Now, you add another layer then in your next chapter by explaining Lewis's perspective on our imagination. Some are aware that his view was romantic, and you made a quick definition a little bit ago, but most are likely to be unsure of what that really means. So please elaborate and note there's a couple books that you mention in your book that helped influence this perspective.
Yes, it's important. And when I use the word romantic, probably at first glance, what most people are thinking of is the way that our wives would like for us to be maybe more romantic. Right. Candlelight dinners and flowers and sweet nothings whispered in the ear. That's not what I have in mind. The word romantic, as Lewis uses it, if you read his book, The Pilgrim's Regress, at the end of that book, it's in the third edition, he gives an afterword, and he tells us, here's what I mean by the word romantic. And he says, it's the idea that the imagination is a faculty, if you like, through which romantic, or through which deep, inconsolable longings can be stirred up. So if you remember in Lewis's early life, he had three of these experiences that he says are fundamental to not only his coming to Christ, but is who he is throughout the rest of his life. The one is where he has a memory of Warney bringing in the biscuit tin with the garden in it. And the memory of that struck him with such a sense of longing that he would have given up anything to have gotten whatever it was that sense in him was leading him to. Another is when he's reading Squirrel Nutkin from Beatrix Potter, and he tells us the idea of autumn arrests him. And that same longing, that deep longing for what he would later come to find out was the transcendent, and most particularly was Christ, that was aroused by that. And then again later he's reading Balder, is dead. Balder the Beautiful is dead when he's reading Tegner's Dropna. And just those lines conjured up the same longing that he'd had with the memory of Warney's biscuit tin garden and Beatrix Potter's Squirrel Nutkin. And Lewis realized that the imagination can do that for us. It can stir up longing, and that is the purpose, one of the purposes for which God has given us that faculty, is to help point us to him by awakening desire. And that's what I mean by romantic.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to clarify for those who may be hearing some of these ideas for the first time. Now, you then go into, I guess, what might consider the meat of your book. You tell us about how Lewis used fiction as a medium to present a pre-evangelistic strategy. And, of course, noting that the Chronicles of Narnia is best known work in this vein. And then you also have already mentioned the other one. But go ahead and explain this strategy and then how Lewis uses it.
Sure. Well, see, Lewis had himself experienced this in his own life. He had read when he was younger George MacDonald's Fantasties. And he tells us in his biography that after he had read that, it baptized his imagination so that the world of common experience was never the same after he'd read that. It had literally re-enchanted him, that sense of wonder. And William, that's the same sense that the pre-Christian had as he went about the world. The post-Christian has almost lost that. Any sense of wonder, of a sense of the sacred, of the transcendent being real in the world. Our world is not just test tubes and gears and wires. It's a world that's full of the presence of God. And therefore, a sense of wonder is appropriate. Well, that's what Lewis got back when he read George MacDonald's Fantasties. And then when he goes and he writes his own stories later, he's trying to help people in part to recapture that themselves. So when he gives you the Chronicles of Narnia, we can think of several times of when he does this. One of the most potent for me is in Prince Caspian. When Caspian, the story begins, Caspian is there. He's heard all of these stories of old Narnia. You know, by now, much time has transpired since The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Prince Caspian. King Miraz, this evil king, has rid the world as best he can of all the talking animals, any of the holdover vestiges of old Narnia. He's tried to snuff out. But Caspian has read and he's heard these rumors of what most people think are myths, fake myths of old Narnia. And he's trying to find out if there's any truth to this. Well, his teacher, Cornelius, comes and, you know, Caspian's been lying awake at night thinking about these things. And in this one scene, Cornelius comes and gets him out of his bed at night. He takes him up the staircase, up to the top of the tower. It's a starlit night. The atmosphere is perfect for what's about to happen. Cornelius and Caspian, they're up top and they're talking in hushed, whispered voices. And Cornelius tells him all the stories you've heard, Caspian, of old Narnia, of the talking animals, of all that evokes wonder. It's all true. It's all true. And Caspian in that scene is joy is awakened and he realizes this is not just a fake myth. And Lewis realizes that in many ways, that's what needs to happen to people with Christianity. They need to be awakened to the deeper reality of the world in which we live. And so he tries to do that through his stories. I can tell you, William, for me, when I first encountered The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it had that effect on me, that re-enchanting effect. And he'll do other sorts of things beyond just re-enchantment. He'll literally pass along Christian ideas to us through the dialogues in these stories. So one that many would maybe be familiar with who'd read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You remember when Lucy has gotten into Narnia and she's come back and told her brothers and her sister about the land. Well, when they go to try to check it out, all they find is the hard back of a wardrobe. There's no magical land there. And they think Lucy's gone crazy or that she's lying. And they go talk to the professor and ask him, and he reasons with them. And he says, well, tell me, who tends to be the more reasonable, Lucy or her brother Edmund? Because, you know, Edmund's taking the opposite view and pretending none of this is real, even though he's been there. And they say, well, you know, that's strange, but up until now we'd have said Lucy every time. And he says, interesting. Well, tell me, the only other option would be that either your sister has gone mad, which one need only look at her to discern that that's not the case, or the third option that we must now assume is correct until more information comes is that she's telling the truth, that this is all true. And what Lewis has given to us in that exchange is his Lord, liar, lunatic argument about Christ, just cloaked in a different form, right? So that same way of reasoning is given to us. So if someone were to think that way and then apply that to Christ, who was Christ? Three options, Lewis tells us. He's either lying, or he was a madman, or the other option, he was telling the truth.
Yeah, sheer genius to be able to fit that into a children's story.
Yes, truly.
Well, Brian, let's go ahead and take a break from your book and have you give the listeners some background about yourself. How did you come to read Lewis, and what's your educational experience, and then what other interests you have in addition to him?
So I came to read Lewis thanks to my second grade teacher, William, Mrs. Simpson, who would read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to us at the end of class every day. She'd read for just 10 minutes or so. I had never heard of those stories until that point. I didn't know who C.S. Lewis was from Adam, but she would read that story at the end of class. And I had never in my life been struck with such a sense of wonder and awe as struck me in that story. And I had such a deep longing of what I thought was a desire to get into Narnia. If there were a real wardrobe anywhere, there was no price too high that I would have paid to get into Narnia, that magical land. And my goodness, to to meet Aslan if I could. I came to realize much later, after I had become a Christian, what that drawing and that longing really was pulling me to, which Lewis himself found out was really Christ, who is the ultimate fountain of all wonder and truth and goodness and beauty. And so that was my first introduction to Lewis. I checked out that book from my school library multiple times, just read it and reread it and reread it. Later for Christmas, one year, my grandparents got me the set, The Chronicles of Narnia, and I read those. Now, I wish I could tell you that all the dots connected for me and I became a Christian at a young age. I did not. I ran from God for many years until I was 20. My life had spiraled out of control into drug addiction. And when I had hit for me what was rock bottom, I went to speak with a pastor who helped me understand that God could forgive me, even someone like me who had so botched my life. And I came to Christ at the age of 20. I then went back and read Lewis's books again because I would hear my pastor at the time, the church I joined, this pastor was quoting from C.S. Lewis. I was thinking, why is he quoting this children's book author? But the quotes he was giving, William, were things that were not from these books that I had read. They were other ideas that made really good sense of Christianity. And then it dawned on me, I discovered that Lewis was this great apologist, this great defender of the faith. So I just started devouring what I could read from Lewis. And when I went back and read The Chronicles of Narnia, now on this side of salvation, as a Christian, I saw so much more in those books, William, that I missed the first times through. And I realized just what a treasure was there for me. And then it all did begin to connect. This is why my heart was so burning when I would read these stories, because, you know, to quote Augustine was right that our hearts have been made for God and they're restless until they find their rest in Him. And that I was experiencing that restless longing, that joy, that desire. So Lewis had that effect on me. And then in going to a seminary here in Wake Forest and spending most of my training in apologetics, you can't ignore Lewis, reading all of his other works, I've just been so impressed with the two things that he brings together for us that are sadly, you rarely see them come together, a great imagination and an ability to communicate beautifully. And on the other side of it, a sharp reason, an ability to make tight arguments and to put all of that together in a way that touches not just the head, but the heart. So Lewis has had a tremendous impact on my life. So for my other interests, William, I did my education in, I just finished up my PhD a little over a year ago, studying the philosophy of religion. And through those studies, I also wrote a book on the Old Testament to try to help people understand how the Bible is not just a book of principles. It's not just a compilation of theological truths. It's certainly not something like Aesop's Fables, a bunch of disconnected stories that teach a good moral lesson, but that it's one unified story that points us to Christ, the promised offspring or seed that we find in Genesis 3, the seed of the woman who will come and one day crush the serpent's head. The whole thing is about that. And to hold that together in a tight unity and in a way that shows people that this too is a story, that it's the story. It's not just a story. It's the story of stories that is meant to enchant us, that's meant to unveil the truth to us that will lead us to Christ. So I wrote that book. And it's available, William, I think you can get the Kindle version on Amazon, I think, but I know that you can get both the paperback and the Kindle version on Crew. I wrote it for Crew, so it's there. And that's another passion of mine is I teach the Bible weekly at our church here in Raleigh, and to help people see how the Bible all makes sense and holds together.
Okay, well, we'll track that down, and I'll have in my show notes how people can get that, as well as the book that we're focusing on. your book, C.S. Lewis, Pre-Evangelism for a Post-Christian World. And speaking of that book, getting back into it, in the process of writing it, what did you enjoy most about the process, and what was the most difficult?
Oh, my goodness. What I enjoyed the most, William, it was, even though this was, it's a lot of work to write a book, as you well know, having written books, what was so enjoyable for me was the sense that this was a thanksgiving back to God, really, and even to Lewis, for having played such, for God having used Lewis in such a pivotal role in my life to bring me to faith in Christ. So it allowed me to dive into the understanding behind what had happened to me in the second grade. And I, by the way, many other experiences throughout my young life of joy, just like Lewis, rising up in me and drawing me upward. I got to dig into that and to try to understand what kind of a world do we live in that kind of phenomenon can happen and does happen to so many different people. You read about this all over the place, not just in Lewis. And so that was incredibly enjoyable in that sense. And the other thing I would say is the more that I read about Lewis the man, and I would encourage others to do this. And again, William, let me just say to you, I'm so grateful for your doing this podcast all about Jack. This helps people. Mm-hmm. The more that I read about Lewis the man, the more impressed I was at not just his apologetic expertise, not just his creativity and his ability to write wonderful stories, but his genuine life as a Christian. How very few people know how much money, for example, he gave of his own money to people in need, but maybe 2/3 of his income to widows, orphans, those who had great need, and how passionate he was about praying for lost friends of his, and how often he would want to share the story of Christianity with them to help them come to Christ. He was just the genuineness of the man, and I would say the courage of the man, who as a professor there, a teacher at Oxford, later a professor at Cambridge, it was not popular to be the kind of a Christian that he was in those days. And yet, he was courageous. He was never mean-spirited about it. He believed what was true. He held to that. And he did a great job as a Christian in a difficult environment. And so it was really a treat for me, William, to get to know the man more by reading so many of these good biographies that have been put out there. In terms of what was most challenging about it, I'd had a really good background training in philosophy. So in terms of thinking about a view of reality, of what philosophers call ontology, which is what I deal with in my second chapter, Lewis's sacramental view of reality. That was not a challenging chapter, but I'll tell you, well, the one that was the one that came right after that. I had not thought very deeply about the imagination, and I had to read a little more broadly outside of my normal field of reading to go and dig up what stood behind Lewis's view of language, symbols, the imagination. And that was probably the most challenging chapter for me. However, having come through it in a way, now thinking about it is one of the most enjoyable things to think about. I'm glad I did it and it's done, but it was a challenge.
Now, returning to the content within your book, the final chapter here is more than just a review. It does recap your overall argument as it challenges others to adopt a Lewisian pre-evangelism approach. But let's have you share some of the elements from that chapter and then use it as a springboard to summarize why listeners should want to read your book.
Sure. So in my last chapter, what I'm doing, I'm really encouraging readers to consider doing something like what Lewis did, in particular those Christians who have a creative gift to be able to write these stories today. And I would say for those who don't have that gift, a good thing that we can do is to go back and to read the stories that have been given to us by Lewis, by Tolkien, by George MacDonald, and others. These stories that do convey to us a deeper sense of reality and that can re-enchant us in the world that we live in. So I'm encouraging that in light of having gone through, you know, the chapter just before the final one, examples of how Lewis does this throughout the Chronicles of Narnia and then throughout the Space Trilogy. Really, I'm trying to show what did it look like, what did pre-evangelism look like? What's it taste like in Lewis's books? And I just show examples of how he does that, walking through those stories.
Well, let me break in, Brian, here. And I was just realizing that earlier when I asked you about a couple books that helped influence his Lewis perspective in relation to the imagination. I don't believe you noted. So go ahead and note that before giving a summary as to why listeners should read your book.
Yeah, great. So there are two books that Lewis mentions in his writings. He says somewhere, anyone who wants to think clearly about these ideas, and he's talking about metaphors, language, the imagination, he says needs to immediately go read two books. And he lists Edwin Bevin's book, Symbolism and Belief, and Owen Barfield's book, Poetic Diction. And he mentions Barfield's book again in Surprised by Joy. You know, he talks about what a great influence Barfield had on him in his coming to Christ. Barfield was the one who cured Lewis of what he calls his chronological snobbery, where the thought that anything new is necessarily better, that new books, new ideas should be preferred over the old. Barfield obliterated that from Lewis's thinking, thankfully, and Lewis realized that, thankfully, that needed to go. But he mentions in there that Barfield's ideas that you find in Poetic Diction, he says, I had already agreed to so many of those. I thought that way. And then when Barfield, you know, put his book out, this really expressed some things I had already come to believe myself. So Barfield both influenced him and then really expressed so much of what Lewis thought about the imagination. And I would highly encourage readers to pick up. I would probably start with Barfield's book, Poetic Diction. I think it's a little more accessible than Bevin's book, but Bevin's would be good too. But probably the most important insight that we find in Barfield that grabbed Lewis was the notion of the good or the true metaphor. This idea that metaphors symbolic metaphors have an essential link to the thing to which they symbolize, the thing to which they point. And a good example of this would be a weeping willow tree representing sad love. The notion of a head bent over, downcast, this is a universal human expression for sadness. And a willow tree that has a similar shape, the bent over branches that hang down, that this kind of a hunching over, that tree therefore serves as a wonderful metaphor for that idea. And Lewis realized, here was the insight, you could take the essence of a thing, redress it in imaginative mythological clothing, and give that to people. And if your redressing had been done in such a way that you chose a good symbol, a fitting metaphor for the thing that you're trying to pass along, then that the magic could happen. They could get something of the essence of the real thing. So probably the easiest example for us is Aslan the lion. What a fitting creature for Lewis to have chosen for Christ. Mm-hmm. A lion, this royal, powerful, kingly figure. And how much better could he have done in looking throughout the animal kingdom? I don't know. I'm grateful he didn't choose a hamster or something. I don't think it would. The associations that we would have put with hamsterness don't quite capture what lioness gives you for Christ, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing you find in Barfield that is just invaluable.
Hmm. Yeah, we were noting before we started recording that myself, not being a academic person, that's not my area that I work in, being more of a lay person broadcasting and then kind of a backdoor way into some Lewis scholarship by the specialty of the quotes and such, but that because of Lewis's mention of the book by Barfield, Poetic Addiction, that's on my radar to read at some point. So I appreciate you.
Yeah, it's fantastic, William.
Noting that. So, all right. Well, let's then go ahead and close out by having you give a quick summary in terms of why listeners, kind of a recap here, why listeners would want to read your book.
Yeah, William, I think that anyone who picks up this book, certainly don't have to be an academic person. Although I have gone through academic training myself, I very much feel like a fish out of water. I'm just a normal guy trying to think about things that have fascinated me too. But my book, if it achieves the purpose for which I set out, the hope is that it would help people to recapture an appreciation of good stories, of enchanted stories that Lewis gives us, that Tolkien gives us, that people like George MacDonald give to us, that some of the great fairy stories give to us, so that we can recapture for ourselves in our daily lives a sense of wonder, that our imaginations might be baptized like Lewis's was in reading MacDonald's Fantasties. And my prayer is that this book can help people achieve that in their own lives. And then beyond that, that we would gain a better understanding of the nature of the world that we live in. I think that's important. That's not just to sit back and because we have too much time on our hands, we don't know what to do, we just sit around and contemplate. That is not the aim. That was not Plato's aim and really the aim of even the great philosophers. They were really after trying to understand reality so that they could know what a good life really was and how they might live that kind of a life. That same aim is true for the Christian. What is this world that God has made? What's it like? And how can our understanding of it and of the imaginations that God has given us help us to live a richer life for Christ? Help us to take up all the tools and the faculties that God has given to us, and in the service of Christ, strengthen those imaginative muscles, recapture the wonder, think very clearly and reasonably about the world. And then finally, again, I just make a plea, William, to Christians to not just to write creative stories for the sake of being creative, and certainly not for self-expression. The artistic world has enough of that. I'm asking Christians to think about helping people to know the truth, to know what's really true, by introducing new stories to us that can convey Christian ideas, that can pre-evangelize this world that we live in that has become so overtaken by naturalism, by the view that there's no such thing or person as God, that the world of the five senses is what Lewis says in Miracles, that's the whole show, to help us put all of our hands to the task and get to work in trying to reach this world through all the avenues that we can. And I just say this as an addendum. Imaginative story is not the way to reach everyone. I'm not saying that this is the approach for everyone. There are some people simply living a Christ-like life, sharing the gospel in a very plain sense. That's the medicine that's needed. For others, though, it does take that pre-evangelistic work, whether by apologetics or by the work of a great story that sends this stuff along in different clothing, so that then when the gospel comes, the heart has been stirred up and prepared for that gospel to take root and to make the change.
Well, excellent. Well, I appreciate you putting together this book to help people understand Lewis's approach into how, one of the ways, it's not the only way, as you're just noting, to be able to reach people. So again, the book is called C.S. Lewis, Pre-Evangelism for a Post-Christian World. And I have been talking with Dr. Brian M. Williams. Thanks, Brian, for being on All About Jack.
William, thanks so much for having me. I've truly enjoyed it, and thanks for the work that you're continuing to do.
Thanks also goes to you, our listener, for your interest in this episode of All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of this podcast. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including material about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a YouTube channel entitled 90 Seconds to Knowing C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today, you heard an interview I did with Brian M. Williams, author of a book that's due for 2021 called C.S. Lewis, Pre-Evangelism for a Post-Christian World. You'll find a link in the show notes to order that book, as well as a link to the other book that he mentioned. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.